This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Dr. Albert Migliori. He is a condensed matter physicist at Los Alamos National Laboratory, and he will be speaking on Friday, the 20th of November at 7 o'clock at Santa Fe Community College about energy storage and the utility grid. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be back.
Always great to have you on the air talking about these incredibly important and very rapidly changing issues. I think the first time we had you on the air was like 4 years ago, and even in that short a time, quite a lot has changed in terms of energy production and the way we're thinking about energy in the U.S.
Well, the world has changed in the last 4 years. We've had a plummet in the price of natural gas.
Why is that?
That has come from the implementation of fracking. This is the use of hydraulic pressure underground to crack rocks so that it'll release the natural gas.
And so that's, of course, a controversial thing in itself.
It is controversial. It has pros and cons. Natural gas produces maybe one-third the amount of carbon, something we're all worried about, per unit of electrical energy. So it seems to be something very good for atmospheric carbon. But it also makes us complacent in trying to solve the long-term problem, where we do not really want to rely wholly on fossil fuels.
Well, and natural gas is a fossil fuel, and it's not renewable.
It is, but it's not as bad as coal. Unfortunately, legislation recently, this is what's called a new source performance standard, has limited CO2 output of coal-fired power plants, and so that there is no existing coal-fired plant that's in compliance with that new standard. This is a good thing. We're starting to wake up to some of the deeper issues and the more important issues here.
So that means no new coal plants are likely to be built, but the old ones will keep on generating electricity?
Yes, there is that, and that's a worry. We've also had the Fukushima TEPCO disaster. And the response of the government to that disaster has deeply affected public opinion. And that's something very important in determining the directions and the strength and the application of new technology.
Meanwhile, we are really in trouble in terms of the amount of carbon in our atmosphere.
Well, for the first time in recorded history, we've crossed the 400 parts per million atmospheric carbon barrier. And that's not just carbon that's a problem. Drought-stricken California, the drought there has hit a new record.
Talk about how the drought in California is related to the larger energy situation.
The use of water is so complicated that I can't get my head around it. But there are a few things to consider. One is that there are areas that in the past, because of the plentiful water supplies, are agricultural meccas. But as it becomes harder to find water for those areas, they become less efficient in growing the food that we need. It's also true that of the more than 1,200 so-called thermoelectric power plants, these are power plants that burn a fuel like coal or natural gas and produce electricity, almost all of them use water. In fact, they use about 3% of the total water that this country uses. That's not a negligible amount. Another aspect of it is that if we begin to run out of water, the only solution is energy. That is, using energy to desalinate water. And that can become especially attractive if we have what's called stranded renewable energy. That is, renewable energy that we don't have a place to put because of a pesky physical law called conservation of energy.
Now, that's a very interesting situation because when we think about renewable energy, one of the main problems with it, and most of what we're looking at, of course, is tremendous advantages, not problems, but one of the problems is the sun shines when it shines, it's cloudy when it's cloudy, it's windy when it's windy, it's still when it's still, and you can't control those things. When you burn coal, you can control exactly how much you're putting in and how much you're burning, and you can control how much energy you're going to get. But during the windy season, let's say, or during the summer when you've got lots of sun, sometimes we're actually creating more energy than we need. Is that true?
Absolutely. And that's extremely important, because behind all of these issues are economics. If you have a wind farm or a solar photovoltaic farm, and it's not producing electricity that you can use because you've got no place to put it, it's making more than the total user base is using at the time, then you have a capital investment that's sitting there doing nothing. And this makes businessmen crazy. So the ideal would be to use those renewable resources, as much as you possibly can.
Okay, so you've got wind turbines, and it's really windy in the spring. Let's look at the state of New Mexico. You might produce more energy than the entire state of New Mexico needs. What could you do with the excess?
Well, that's where technology seems to be slowly but inexorably marching on. You don't actually have to store it. If you can find somebody else who needs it, say you're producing wind energy in New Mexico and Louisiana desperately needs some electrical energy, you can manipulate the flow of electricity throughout the entire utility grid by being very smart about it, and so move electricity from where it's being generated to where it's needed over extremely long distances.
Doesn't it lose a lot of energy over distance?
The losses are negligible.
Is that right?
It is. It's more like you're shuffling it. So we might push a little bit of electricity, say, into Oklahoma, and they push a little bit into the next neighboring state. And so you're not really moving that electricity across the entire country, number one. Number two, the efficiency of electric power transmission is pretty darn good.
Now, what about, there are times of the year where you might have excess energy, but in the winter when it's cloudy, there's not a lot of sun, the days are short, and maybe there's not a lot of wind either, there's not going to be enough energy.
Well, there you go. So one other approach is to actually physically store the energy. The device you're most familiar with for energy storage is battery. But a battery is an object that it's kind of expensive. Every cubic centimeter of a battery costs a lot of money. It'd be really nice to have energy storage systems that are really cheap and economic. And this is critical. The economics raises its head, and it has to drive the technology. So there are some approaches, and they're beginning to firm up.
What are some of those other approaches for energy storage?
Well, there's an incredibly simple Stone Age one that we can pull off here in New Mexico, but it'd be really hard to do this in Kansas. And that involves building something like a 10-acre lake at high elevation in New Mexico. You could hide it in a valley, it would be almost invisible. And you put another 10-acre lake down somewhere at a town site, and you connect them with a pipe, and inside the pipe is a water turbine electrical generator. You can pump water uphill when you've got a lot of extra solar and wind, and it'll just sit there. And it's hard to come up with something cheaper than a hole in the ground for energy storage. And then you recover it when you need it.
So then you basically have hydroelectric energy.
But it's manufactured hydroelectric, so it's actually going both ways. You can store and recover energy this way. And it's remarkable that the technology for this is almost completely economically competitive with a gas-fired power plant that's used to handle the peak loads of electrical consumption in a state like New Mexico.
Why would this be usable in New Mexico and not in Kansas?
Well, Kansas doesn't have the elevation changes that New Mexico has.
Right, right.
And that brings up another point, and that is that every single viable technology is going to be used, and you shouldn't reject micro-pumped hydroelectric in New Mexico because it won't work in Kansas.
Right. I mean, how much of a role does evaporation of that water play?
That's actually an interesting question. The whole state of New Mexico is floating on salt water that you can't use for agriculture and you can't drink. It's denser, doesn't evaporate as fast. So you could use that brackish water as the energy storage mechanism.
Okay.
There's another third aspect to this whole problem. So we mentioned manipulating the grid to find somebody who needs energy when you don't. We just talked about one example, and we'll get to some others, about how to store energy, that is, in a man-made lake. And a third is to use that energy in industrial applications that are able to turn themselves on and off. When electricity is cheap, they go. When it's not, they turn themselves off. So think about desalination. We're having a massive drought problem. California is hit record levels. New Mexico this year is pretty good, but it's been suffering from a lack of water. You could use stranded, that is excess renewable energy that you don't have a place to put, to desalinate water.
For example, that brackish water you were talking
about. For example, that brackish water. You could also make aluminum. Aluminum is colloquially called solid electricity.
Really? What does that mean?
The entire production of aluminum is essentially tied to the cost of the electrical energy required to extract it from an incredibly cheap and plentiful ore.
And so if you located an aluminum processing, an aluminum making plant, whatever it's called, next to a wind farm, then whenever there was excess energy, it would run.
And you'd have to work out how to make everybody happy with that.
Yeah. But which is non-trivial.
It's not trivial, but this is where legislation is extremely important, because legislation can provide incentives that make this work that only affect the economics a tiny bit, but make huge differences in how we deploy the technology we do have.
What would be an example of legislation that made a positive impact on getting wind energy out there?
Well, there have been enormous tax credits over the last 30 years to bring wind energy up to economic viability. It's been so effective that, all things being equal, and when you need the energy, wind is fully competitive with fossil energy sources. And so those credits are now starting to go away. But those credits have proven to be effective. Let's see if we can make them work for electrical energy storage systems and a smart utility grid and industries that can turn on and off depending on the availability of electricity. That could be legislated.
There are some technological challenges, you've made in some of your papers the distinction between a technological challenge and a scientific challenge, and maybe you can explain to us what that means. In advancing energy storage to a point where we can be a 100% renewable nationwide energy economy?
There are two issues. You bring them up, science and technology. The micro-pumped hydroelectric is simply a technology problem. We know how to do every single piece of the construction of such a facility.
Why don't we have them?
We don't have them because they're not quite as cheap as burning natural gas. And nobody's tried to build them. So there is a conservatism in the power industry that they don't necessarily want to try something new because they're so tightly constrained legally with the operation of a public utility.
And at the same time, if it's almost competitive with natural gas and it is renewable, you'd think They'd want to do it, and the public would certainly want it.
Yeah, but a few percent economic error makes a big difference, and all we have to do is fix that with a little bit of legislation, and we could probably get that to fly.
Okay, but anyway, back to what you were saying, the pumped hydroelectric is an engineering challenge that actually there's not even a challenge. All they have to do is build them. But there are some challenges, scientific and engineering, where there's still research needed.
Huge amounts. So let's consider, for the moment, an ordinary battery, like might be in your flashlight. Big batteries are pretty similar. They have lots of complicated stuff inside and lots of chemicals, and they have a lifetime that's dependent on many things, but it's not infinite. But there's another type of battery called a flow battery, where one has some little gadget. Let's call it a gadget. And you put electricity in, and liquid chemicals come out that you pump into a giant plastic tank or a giant steel tank. So we're getting into the same cost model as a hole in the ground to hold water. So we're talking about a plastic tank. It's not anything much cheaper than that for holding energy. Then when you need the energy, you run it back out of that plastic tank through a gadget, and out comes electricity.
What's in the tank?
In the tank are fairly complicated chemicals.
Okay.
None of them are expensive. None of them are particularly toxic. But the science in getting that to work at efficiencies that are comparable to pumped hydroelectric isn't quite there, but there's no scientific roadblock that says we can't get there. So we have to work on this.
So these flow batteries, where's the technology at? How well do they work? Are they being used? Are they economically viable?
The technology, we're right in the middle of it. The Los Alamos National Lab is working frantically to improve the efficiency and reduce the cost and increase the longevity of flow batteries. So is Pacific Northwest National Lab and other national labs. It's very promising. It looks very good because it's most of the energy is just stored in a big plastic or steel tank.
That is a hope. Now, when you've got these flow batteries, how would they be used? Would they be used in people's houses? Would they be used by public utilities?
They're pretty much controlled by the economics of scale. The bigger the better, the bigger the cheaper. One could, and it's not unreasonable to have a flow battery in your house, or even one shared among, say, a dozen houses. But the most important application would be large-scale grid energy storage. And this is a strong direction that everyone who is thinking about these sorts of things believe is viable at the moment.
One of the conversations that happens when people are talking about having a resilient energy grid, maybe a grid that isn't quite so vulnerable to, for example, terrorist attacks, a grid that has more local control, is municipal, distributed municipal energy. So when you look at, you know, on the one hand, having a power plant that covers the whole state or half the state, or on the other end of the scale, solar panels on top of your house that covers your house and that's it, what's in between? Is that something that you're looking at?
It's interesting that you mention that, because the U.S. actually has only three utility grids. East, West, and not surprisingly, Texas.
Texas has its own grid.
Texas has its own grid. That connects flaws over very large distances in the U.S. It'd be really nice to have lots more utility grids. The microgrid problem that you mentioned is enormously resilient, because that gives you the opportunity to implement technology that maybe isn't quite ready for a 1,000-acre power plant storage system. And you can find out a lot about how it works. So it would be nice. And the way to implement those things is with a very smart set of connections among a lot of microgrids. And that engages the mathematics of modeling the utility grid to make best use of it.
So are you working on this kind of grid modeling?
Los Alamos is certainly one of the leaders in understanding the grid modeling required to accept and distribute renewable energy and best use of the utility grid over national length scales, distance scales. Los Alamos is also deeply invested in flow batteries. These are the...
What you were talking about. So I'm just going to try to summarize and see if this is right. You've got a national grid. You've got three national grids. You've got the East, the West, and Texas. They are made up of mostly large utilities that are often monopolies in whatever part of the state that they're in. And there's not all that much renewable energy, solar and wind, at this point on those grids. Those grids, in order to be updated, have to accept energy that is unpredictable in its generation, unlike fossil fuel energy like coal and so on. And it has to figure out what kind of storage it's going to use. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah.
And it can also, when you're modeling what an updated grid and a renewable energy grid would look like, you might have more municipal scale grids, what you called microgrids.
Mm-hmm.
And you're working on all that.
And I'll also make the point that the smart grid and energy storage are deeply and intimately connected. That is, one can reduce the urgency of the other, and implementing both beautifully will vastly increase our ability to accept renewable energy.
So we're talking about batteries, we're talking about flow batteries, we're talking about in states that are not completely flat, pumped hydroelectric. What else in terms of storage?
There are a lot of technologies. There are things like underground compressed air, flywheels, ordinary, at least in my jargon, more ordinary battery technology, and more. But the big ones really are the ones where the storage medium, the actual storage device, is mostly cheap. And of course, manipulating the grid requires mathematics and data, but it's not so intensely expensive as the energy storage technology.
If you, Albert Migliori, could basically say, this is the research and development we're going to do over the next 25 years. Here's where we're going to allocate resources, get the best minds working in terms of science and technology. How would you allocate that? Like, if we were going to have, there's many people who say, we need a Manhattan Project for energy. You know, what would that look like for you?
Oh, it could be absolutely wonderful. We've talked a little bit about specific technologies, but in the end, the very smart utility grid and any viable energy storage technology work together. That is, the better you do with the grid, the less urgent it is to store the energy, and the more energy you can store, the less the urgency is of delivering energy over long distances to other users. So these two work absolutely together, and I consider energy storage to also include novel uses of large amounts of renewable energy, such as desalination. So we need a complete spectrum of research in energy storage, from digging holes in the ground for pumped hydroelectric to the most advanced chemistry. We need to implement the instrumentation and the extremely complex mathematics to make the utility grid as smart as you possibly can make it. And we need to be able to configure as many industries as we can that connect to large uses of electricity so that they can be operated on demand and so act as a bank to put in renewable energy that might otherwise be wasted.
There's some places, and maybe we can talk about what's going on in the rest of the world, but like Burlington, Vermont is now running on 100% renewable energy. And it's not the sunniest place. It's not like New Mexico. It's like If it's already working now in a city, why can't we do it everywhere now? I guess that's the question that I have and that so many others have.
The trouble is how they do that computation. For example, let's say that you compute the total energy that, say, Denmark produces over the course of a year to the total energy they consume. If they produce more than they consume, then they can say that they are running completely on renewables. But there's a hidden flaw. And the flaw is when on the day, the afternoon, the evening, when their wind energy resources are not producing enough energy to run Denmark, they have to pull energy from somebody else's utility grid. Worse still, when Denmark is producing a lot more energy than they're using, they actually have to dump that into the European utility grid, which is destabilizing the EU grid while Denmark waves the flag of being completely energy self-sufficient with renewables.
So now this has happened.
This has happened, and it's not fair. It's a sham.
But it doesn't seem like a sham. Denmark is producing excess energy and providing Europe with energy.
Yes, and Europe is shutting down coal and nuclear plants because they're stuck with Denmark's renewable energy, and when they shut these plants down, there are enormous costs for startup and shutdown, and the plants run less efficiently when they're producing small amounts of energy because they're getting a lot of unwanted wind energy at a particular time.
And at the same time, many people, when they hear they're shutting down coal and nuclear plants, they stand up and cheer and say, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, produce more, and then we can shut them down for good.
So just imagine Denmark, and you pull the plug from the European utility grid. Then Denmark can't function.
What do you mean?
They must then bring on fossil and nuclear energy sources, because they don't have the EU grid to bring in energy when they're not producing it from their renewable sources. So they're not independent.
So you're saying it actually is a two-way street.
And just imagine if Europe decided to do the same thing, put in so much wind energy that they could claim to be completely renewable energy powered. But where do they put the energy when they're making it and they don't have it? Remember, they're averaging over the course of a year. So you can't implement that globally.
What about, I mean, when you look at Vermont and Burlington did that, their energy is coming from, in the report that I read about it, wind, water, and biomass. Biomass is tree clippings or whatever. It's biological stuff that you can burn, wood, essentially. So that you can burn it whenever you want.
Same goes for the water resources. Those are pretty good. And hydroelectric power is one of the finest power sources one could ever hope for.
So Burlington, Vermont is now 100% renewable energy. It's part of a goal to be 90% renewable energy by the year 2050. And one would think New Mexico could do that too with our vast amounts of land, sun, and wind. It's an inspiration. And for so many of us, I mean, I guess what it looks like from the layman's point of view, from the journalist's point of view, is that what's in the way is not so much the science and technology, but the politics, the lack of incentives, the tremendous lobbying power of the fossil fuel companies, the disinformation campaign about climate change that was so effective for so many years, stuff like that.
Well, let's just look at the 90% and the 100% numbers for Vermont and the city in Vermont. Think about 90% renewable. Let's say you had no other source of energy. You're only renewable and you're at 90%. That means 3 days a month you're going to have no electricity. That's pretty rough for modern civilization to accept.
Yeah, or a few hours between, you know, at 2 a.m.
Yeah, I'm kind of okay with that, but a lot of people aren't. However, the 100% is an interesting number, because the only way Burlington can hit 100% is if they are connected to the national, at least the eastern utility grid, and Very smart grid operators are able to shuffle power in and out, so they absolutely rely on the utility grid. So does that 90% number. So would New Mexico at 90%, except if you have energy storage in sufficient quantities and sufficiently economical, you can actually go to 100%, and you don't have to cheat by borrowing somebody else's utility grid, whether or not they want you to use it. So there's the conservation of energy physical law kicking in. If you have energy storage, then you never need to run a fossil energy source. That's a long way off.
Is it really?
Well, the economics drive this again. So let's say you could hit 90% for the whole United States, and you're not connected to anybody else's utility grid. So the United States is now an island for the purposes of energy generation. If you could hit 90%, and the remaining 10% was coming from nuclear and hydro and perhaps a little bit of biomass is we can consider renewable, but just consider us hitting 90%. That would be absolutely stupendous. When you combine that reduction in non-renewable energy sources with the increasing efficiency of electrical consumption, our flat panel TVs, LED lighting, permanent magnet motors, all of these have reduced enormously the amount of electricity we need to run everyday and industrial sorts of things. We have knocked out so much carbon that the only remaining bits are going to be transportation. And even there, if we have enough electricity, we can use that to run battery-powered vehicles and get rid of even more fossil fuel-burning things. You don't have to hit 100%. If you could hit 90%, it would be pretty wonderful.
When you look at these questions on a worldwide scale, how are these questions different? I mean, we've got electricity everywhere in the United States. What about developing countries that don't have the kind of grids that we have? Are they in a more advantageous place because they don't have to fix a broken grid or an outdated grid?
There's two things to note here. One is that typically an underdeveloped country, in fact, often it's the case in countries that have missed out on some aspect of technology, they leapfrog an intermediate technology and go to the next one. For example, the African continent has basically gone from no telephones to cell phones
right,
without hitting the intermediate technology of hardwired phone lines. So they leapfrogged over that one. Right now, you mentioned, well, what if you didn't have electricity for a few hours a day? Well, what if you don't have electricity at all, and all of a sudden you go to a system where you have electricity for most of the day? It would be fabulous, and it'd be very easy to accept that difference between the way we work here in the United States, where we can't bear to be without electricity for even 10 seconds, and having no electricity. So yeah, there's a huge advantage there. You don't have to have things so perfect. And that means that you could go to 100% renewables, accepting 10% or 20% outage, and be in pretty good shape. So I think there is an advantage.
Now, the price of solar panels, I mean, I've seen these graphs, it has dropped precipitously and will continue to probably drop precipitously as technology gets better and competition increases and it becomes more common. What if every homeowner in the United States were to put a solar panel on their house, which basically was enough to feed their house and put some energy onto the grid? There are people in New Mexico who are getting a negative utility bill. They're getting money back. How would that affect the energy picture of the United States?
Well, it's wonderful that photovoltaics have dropped in price, but everybody can't dump power into the utility grid simultaneously and have a negative utility bill. This is, again, the conservation of energy issue. So as the widespread use of rooftop photovoltaics increases, the restrictions on putting that energy into the utility grid are going to go up so that you don't destabilize the utility grid. Unless you have energy storage and unless you can take the energy in the Sun Belt and dump it into places that don't have the beautiful sun we have in New Mexico.
Lots of interesting questions, and you will be not only discussing these questions, but taking questions and answers from audience members at your talk on Friday, November 20th at 7 o'clock at the Santa Fe Community College. Dr. Albert Migliori will be giving a talk about energy storage and the utility grid. Anything else you want to let people know or anything you want to leave people with before we go?
I think the most important concept here is to remember that we're not all in isolation. We can't just make as much energy as we please and hope there's some place to put it. Denmark has tried that. If everybody did it, all of the systems fail. So we've got to figure out how to handle, store, and manipulate and transmit renewable energy before it'll take over the world.
Albert Migliori is a condensed matter physicist at Los Alamos National Laboratory. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Mary Charlotte, thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.